What I'd like to do today is I'm a priest scientist, and it's a rare combination. It's really striking because in so many ways, it's an unexpected combination. So a few weeks ago, I went to the AAAS annual meeting in Austin, and it always freaks people out to discover that I am a priest scientist. And when I go to meetings like Cold Spring Harbor, I speak about my science during the day, and so often at night, what happens is my colleagues, you know, they'll say something to the effect of, I've always wanted to talk about God to someone, and I always thought believers were not smart, but I think you're smart, so let's talk about God. So we'll go for a walk. And what I'd like to talk to you today is to talk to you about the vocation of a scientist. And because I'm a Catholic priest, I'm also going to speak in a very specific way about the vocation of a Catholic scientist and how this particular vocation has to be understood within the wider context of divine providence. So my talk is going to be divided into three parts. I'm going to talk first about vocation. What exactly is a vocation? And I'm going to contrast that with the contemporary accounts of identity. We live in a world where identity is it. And as a believer, as a Christian, identity actually comes second after vocation. There's an idea that you cannot know who you are unless you first know Jesus Christ and how Jesus Christ has called you to life. This is a very stark contrast to the current account of identity, which in so many ways assumes that you construct the identity from within. Then we're going to talk about the scientist, and I'm going to, when I give talks like this, I often give talks on, and I gave a talk a few weeks ago at MIT for the Thomistic Institute, and we talked about the ethics of CRISPR. And then sometime before that, we talked about Adam and Eve, and how do you take the current account of paleogenomics and bring that into conversation with an authentic reading of Genesis 1 to 3. This is the first time I'm not actually talking specifically about a science-related topic. I'd like to talk about the philosophy of science, particularly the philosophy of what it means to be a scientist. Now, this is the Thomistic Institute, so I'm going to refer to the Aristotelian tradition. The Aristotelian tradition is anchored by Aristotle, so this is 300 years before Christ or so. But his thought forms he is the head of a river of thought that goes through 2,000 years of Western civilization. And one of the preeminent members of that tradition is St. Thomas Aquinas. So because I'm a Dominican, and it's not that I'm a Dominican, and so I tend to talk about other Dominicans, like St. Thomas is the Dominican, but for Catholics, St. Thomas holds a privileged status in the theological tradition because he is one of the high points. He's able to synthesize everything that comes before him, 1,300 years of thought, philosophy, theology, and, well, the natural sciences coming together at one point. And everything after that in the Catholic tradition has, if you are doing anything in Catholic theology today, you have to engage in a conversation with Thomas. So I'm going to be focusing primarily on the Aristotelian tradition. And then so you have a discussion of vocation. We're talking about scientists, the vocation of a scientist. And the third part, very specifically, the vocation of a Catholic scientist, especially the vocation of a Catholic scientist in a pluralistic, secular, and, dare I say, post-Christian society, which is what we live in today. What does that mean? And I'll talk primarily from my own experience, because I travel to meetings, I put grants into the NIH, and they get freaked out because I'm under PI salary. I have to put zero because I'm out of poverty. And so my grants officer has to write a letter that goes to the study section to explain why the budget is the way it is. And the study section sends it back, and they say, this is so weird. People are trying to get a ton of money for their salary, and here you are asking for no money. So we will talk about what it means to be a Catholic scientist in that age, in our age. So first we'll begin with vocation. And it comes, of course, from the Latin word for vocare, which is to call. It's a calling. Now, I want you to notice that vocation, because it implies a calling, presupposes a caller. And so this is a distinctively theistic account of one's purpose and mission in life. Because if there is no caller, you cannot be called. But the Christian account of vocation situates the individual human being who is utterly unique. Right? So there, the Christian tradition will say that the human being, each of us, is irreducibly unique, and it's so unique that your mission in life can only be accomplished by you, no one else before you, and no one else after you. And so the call is always situated within the tapestry, the account of history, where God is at the center of providence. And I teach at Dominican University, Providence College. And so we have we're constantly reminded in this city of Providence that God is in charge of everything. And when I teach a class this semester on science and religion, and we spend a lot of time talking about how do you take this into account? How can one coherently say that every single snowflake in the snowstorm 2 days ago was actually thought of, guided by, and intended by God, right? And so there's an incredibly strong sense of providence, and that this coheres very well with free will. We spend an entire week in my class talking about that. How do we talk about free will, and how free will can be intelligently put into conversation with a strong account of divine providence? I'm going to take that for granted in this conversation. I'm just going to simply say that for a Christian, that's a given. That you and I have a place. Now, and the idea here is that this place is uniquely configured for you. When I go off to high schools and elementary schools and I talk about heaven, I say that one of the things that heaven is about is you get to see the tapestry of providence. You see the tapestry of history. And what I mean by that is you get to see history spread out in front of you from the beginning of time to the end of time. And you see everything. And you see your particular place in that tapestry. But what is really, really cool is that it's not only that you see the front of the tapestry, what you actually get to see is you get to see the reverse. And if you've ever seen the back of a tapestry, what you can see is that you can see all the threads of the tapestry, you know, basically weaving their way inside and out to give rise to the image on the other side. And you can see how this life of this young girl in the 12th century actually impacted the molecular biologists of Hopkins in the 21st century. See? And there's in this deep account of providence where every human person is linked, where every human person is linked by grace, there is an account where our lives are intertwined and are connected in ways that transcend geography and history. And so and I will talk about this later, how the Catholic scientist who is struggling through the 9th experiment that has, you just can't clone that gene. No, it took me 18 months to clone my gene. It was a nightmare. And it turned out that my gene was toxic in E. coli. And so the libraries that I was using in order to clone my gene by complementation in yeast were underrepresented for this particular gene. Of course, this, you don't know this. And of course, everyone around you thinks that you're just incompetent. And you just keep doing it over and over again. There's a lot of suffering there. And graduate school involves suffering. Science involves suffering. And we'll talk about how that has to play a role within a Catholic vision of what a scientist is called to be in a post-Christian world. So when you look at that account of providence, the idea is that you are invited to discover where your place is. in the 21st century, in 2018, what are you supposed to be doing? Where are you going to do it? And I'm going to propose to you that what one discerns is one discerns the friendships that you will need to live in this world. It's a very interesting account. It actually comes from Aquinas. Aquinas basically uses friendship as an organizing principle that weaves its way through his theology. He will use the account of friendship, and we're going to talk about the Aristotelian account of friendship. My students in their freshman year, all of them are required to read the Nicomachean Ethics, whether you're majoring in biology or you're majoring in history. The first semester, you read the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, and you focus on books 8 to 9, and you talk about friendship. And Aristotle defines friendship in a particular way. He says it's a relationship between peers that involves a mutual willing of the good for the other that is reciprocated, right? Where there is a shared common task. And he describes three different kinds of friendship. He calls one utilitarian friendship. Now, I'm going to use examples to show you that this is not how we think of friendship today. One example, for example, if you went in to a barber, you and the barber have a friendship. Because you see, hopefully, you have a mutual goodwill towards each other. He really wants to cut your hair. You like him enough that you walk into his barbershop rather than the barbershop down the street. So there's a mutual goodwill there. And there's a common task. He has to cut your hair, and you will compensate him for that. And so there's a utilitarian account of friendship. Then there's the friendship based on pleasure. And here you can imagine someone who simply, well, you're on a frisbee team. And both of you are playing the game. You are friends. Again, hopefully we have a mutual relationship of goodwill. We also have a common task, which is to beat the other team. And so this is a friendship. But he will describe the third kind of friendship, which is the friendship of virtue, the friendship of excellence, where what you share is a mutual task of challenging the other and self to become a virtuous person, to become better, a better human being, a more excellent human being, the kind of human being who flourishes in his or her surroundings. And I would propose to you that the discernment of a particular vocation is a discernment, it is a search, it is an inquiry, self-reflection, on the kind of needs that you need to fulfill the virtue of friendship in your life. Now, in the Catholic tradition, there are usually three major vocational classes. The first is you wish to have a friendship with God, and that friendship is a direct one. And that is the vocation of a man like myself, a man who is consecrated and set apart to work solely on friendship with God. And he can be a hard friend, but an incredibly mysterious one and a seductive one at that. Then there is the vocation where one is called to develop a friendship with God, again, because this is a theological account, it's a friendship with God through one other person. And this is the vocation that we associate with marriage. And the idea here is that the friendship with God is through a family, and that the struggles of developing the friendships within the family are actually means by which you develop friendship with God. And then there is the third, and I think this is a third that has not really been appreciated as much, which is the development of a friendship with God through numerous friends. And this is really the single vocation. This has not been as reflected upon in the last, you know, if you talk about the last 2,000 years of the Christian church, you don't really have that single vocation. Because until recently, there was no place for the single person. But the idea here in recent theology is that one reflects on how the single person, through service and friendships with numerous people, is able to grow in the virtue of friendship, which of course Thomas will describe with regard to God as the virtue of charity or love. And you grow in love through your friends. And the idea here for the discernment of virtue and the discernment of one's vocation is one has to figure out how many friends do you need in order to flourish. For some people, there is the friendship with God is sufficient. For others, there is a need for the exclusive one-on-one friendship that we associate with marriage. For others, not so much. They have many, many friends. Now, I sophomore year, so this is the second semester. Starting next week, I begin advising for registration. And this is when seniors have to finally declare their major. And this is incredibly painful for millennials. It's very difficult for millennials to declare a major. FOMO is very hard. Because the worry is, with 55 majors, I pick one. What about the other 54? One could be better, you see? So this is how I have to sit there with my students, and we need to think. And this is part of the discernment. What is striking is they are so worried that they will miss out on the one that they could have had that they do not think about the one that they chose. And so trying to help someone discern a vocation involves encouraging him or her to undergo a process of self-reflection. Now, as a Dominican, the account here, because it presupposes such a strong account of providence, assumes that whatever it is God wants you to do, he has prepared you for that from the beginning of time. So I was talking to a student who was considering an English major. She's like, I think I want to be English. I really, really think English is it. And during the conversation, it became very clear. It just kind of slipped out. She really didn't like reading. I said, this is a big problem. It didn't occur to her, that in order for her to embrace the major, there are already certain predispositions and desires that you assume are present. And when we talk about the scientists, we're going to talk about scientists have a particular configuration of traits, right? And it has to deal with wonder. And we'll talk about what wonder means. But if someone doesn't have wonder, it's really hard for them to be a scientist. Because when it is 3 o'clock in the morning and you have been in lab for the last 15 hours and your cells aren't cooperating or the Western is just not working out, you better have a passion to understand, to respond to this call of wonder. And so we have to talk about these traits. And so for the Christian, the account of discerning a vocation presupposes that there are already clues in your past that God has placed there to point to what your purpose and role is to be in this tapestry of providence. And so my responsibility is to look for that with you. It's not about how you feel. You see, there a lot of people will talk about, there has to be data. You see, there has to be data in your life that points to a certain reasonable expectation you will flourish in this particular life. Now, what do you think about in regards to vocation? You don't only talk about virtues, which is your strengths. You also have to talk about your weaknesses, the vices especially. And then there are wounds. And this is a very striking thing. I was at a conference at the Vatican a few years ago, and I was speaking to a well-established scientist. And we were on the bus to the airport coming from this convention, this conference, this Third International Stem Cell Conference at the Vatican. And he was asking me, as a priest, you know, we're having a conversation dealing with figuring out life. And I was talking about the strengths, the weaknesses, and the wounds. And he said, what is a wound? And I said, a wound is a deep block to your being able to form the kind of friendships that you desire. And then he said, I have no wounds. And I sighed and I said, why are you sighing, dog? Because it means that you have not really experienced love. And he looked at me and goes, you're right. Now, one of the things that, so you have strengths, you have weakness, and these wounds are those inclinations, tendencies within us that get in the way of the kind of human relationship that we need to respond to the call of love. And self-knowledge, so when my students say, Father, when will I know when I'm grown up? See? I know they say, what is that? When will I know when I'm grown up? And I say, you will understand yourself enough that you will understand not only how good you are, but how bad you are, and how parts of you, given where you are, can't be changed. And the assumption among very young people is you can change everything. And I think as you mature, especially as a priest who accompanies many people in life, you discover that at some point you realize that there are things about you that simply cannot be changed. And they are preventing you from being the kind of person you want to be. Now, if I was talking purely theologically, I would say, but even those blocks are accessible to Christ's grace. And that's a different situation. But the self-awareness to discern one's vocation requires some minimal self-knowledge of those three dimensions of your life. Now, it's striking because a lot of young people assume that discernment is done alone. But if you look at Aristotle and Aquinas, they will propose to you that discernment, figuring out your vocation, can only be done in the context of the community, because we are prone to self-deception. You really don't know yourself in the way that your lab mates know you. There are certain things about you that your lab mates know about you that, if they told you, may surprise you, but actually ring true to you when you think about it. Often they deal with just the kind of flaws in our personality, in our character. And other people tend to see these better than we see them in ourselves. And so discernment is often done, this is contrary to the account today in a postmodern society, the proper account of discernment is always within the community. And then you discover. So now let's just talk about the vocation of a scientist. So again, we'll begin with Aristotle. Now Aristotle, you may or may not know this, is first and foremost a biologist. Most of his writing is on biological issues rather than philosophical or metaphysical issues. He's a biologist through and through. And he was what we would call today a natural historian. He was incredibly good at observing and describing what he saw. Now, in his account, he would probably self-identify himself as a philosopher of nature. Because philosophy here in the time of the Greeks did not mean what it means today, which is a very specific area of intellectual work. It basically meant the search for truth. And the philosopher of nature was someone who was thinking about things that change and letting things change. So biologists, by definition, under that schema, are philosophers of nature. And when he describes the origin of philosophy, he will say it begins with wonder. Now, if you look at Richard Dawkins' memoir, it is an appetite for wonder. I don't know, I haven't read that memoir, I don't know whether or not he is hearkening back to Aristotle, but wonder, I propose to you, is at the heart of the scientific enterprise. It's not just the heart of the scientific, it is the heart of many, many different things that we do. Poets also begin with wonder. And so we'll talk about what is wonder. And I tried to define it. And the best definition, I've read up on wonder, the best definition is it's a mixed emotion that brings together surprise and curiosity. I want you to explore that. And I want you to reflect upon whether or not this defines what scientists do. So the surprise is that there is a gap between what you expect, or what you expected, and what you observe. There is a gap. You go, wow. But you see, you have to go beyond that. He says, it's not just being surprised at that gap. It has to simultaneously be accompanied with a curiosity to fill the gap. Because there are people who will be surprised and it makes me, wow, look. I mean, you can see this, you know. People say, wow, it's snowing. It should snow. And that's it. And then the other people will start Googling. And this is the scientist, of course. The scientist is going to try to accumulate data. Now, the difference is between a philosopher and a scientist, as we understand today, is that the philosopher of the scientist today is what I would call a practical philosopher. And here I bring up the example of St. Albert the Great, another Dominican, patron saint of scientists. And there are stories of him walking around in his habit, just like mine, and he had a lump of lead in his habit pocket, right? So here's my habit pocket. And he'd have a lump of lead here. And the reason why he had a lump of lead is because he had read in Aristotle that ostriches ate lead. And he had a lump of lead in his pocket just in case he ever ran into an ostrich. He wanted to take the lead and try to feed it to the ostrich. Now, this is the scientific mind. Okay? Aristotle, check out the ostrich. Albert the Great carrying around the instruments that he will need, the reagents that he will need to do his experiments when he comes upon an ostrich. That is 800 years ago. And then, of course, you have the scientific revolution during the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, where it becomes much more utilitarian. Science, the program by Francis Bacon and Descartes and Locke, has to deal primarily with the manipulation of nature for useful reasons. See, for Aristotle, it's not useful in the sense of I'm going to do it in order to make money, or I'm going to do it in order to find a cure. I'm going to do it because I want to know. You see? So he begins with wonder. And that gap that you are supposed to fill in is filled in with knowledge. And for modern scientists, the scientific enterprise is a movement from wonder to knowledge. But if you go back to Aristotle, the movement should be, in his mind, a movement from wonder to wisdom. And so we have to explore the difference between knowledge and wisdom. So knowledge for the ancients was simply an explanation for what that gap is. And in my particular case, my students and I are trying to figure out the function of yeast Bax inhibitor. And next week, we are going to a lab at Harvard. We are collaborating because we are, for the first time in 8 years, we are able to begin a small molecule screen looking for inhibitors of our protein. That's very cool. We're finally able to express it in E. coli, show as a channel. You know, so we have knowledge. And my students are like, oh, yeah, we know this little bit. And science, especially modern science, tends to focus on knowledge. Aristotle will talk about wisdom. And wisdom is an explanation that takes everything into account. Now, Stephen Hawking died a few days ago. It is interesting. They called him one of the most brilliant scientists of our century, but they don't call him wise. So there's a difference between brilliance and wisdom. Brilliance is basically the ability to penetrate and acquire knowledge. What is a wise person? Wisdom assumes that you're able to see the bigger picture. Now, we're talking more than grand unified theories. So they brought that up. My students have been talking about that, because if you read all the obits of for Stephen Hawking, they always talk about his work with black holes and his interest in cosmology to identify a grand unifying theory that would take all the fundamental forces of nature and put them into one equation you can print on your t-shirt. Yeah. Right? I mean, that is the dream. But from the classical Aristotelian account, that is still knowledge, because it's limited. It is limited to the material world. It only talks about mechanism. Wisdom here implies deeper causality. The understanding not of physics, but of metaphysics. Why is stuff here now? Not just what is the stuff doing, but why is it here now? Now, one of the things, when I entered the Dominican Order after finishing my PhD in biology, I had to take philosophy. And I remember the first year fighting against my philosophy professors because I said, why do I need this? I know science. You see? And there's a certain arrogance in science. Scientists are the high priests of a post-Christian society. We just know it. And if we know it, it's true. And if we don't know it, it isn't. And one of the striking things is my Dominican brothers, who are philosophy professors, were able to impress upon me that philosophy is also about theories. And I understood that because I'd spent graduate school basically developing a theory of aging and trying to figure out how genes impacted this theory. And it's an account, it's an explanation. But what philosophers are able to do is they're able to reflect on the deeper realities, the metaphysics of the physics that science can show us, where physics is simply a general term for biology, physics, and chemistry, which is the study of physical things. And so the call to wisdom is the kind of call where the human being is able to see himself in the big picture, not as a lump of matter, but as a person. And so Aristotle, this is even pre-Christian, will talk about the first cause. And he will talk about how you need a first cause to provide a coherent explanation for why grand unified theories are even possible. And you see, that study, so this is not even theology, this is not Christianity, this is pagan philosophy, that attempt to explain everything at the level of causality is what he will call wisdom. And so you see this movement from pure knowledge to wisdom. Now, this is a very difficult thing for me to talk about when I go to MIT, because wisdom is something that is put aside. It is considered radically subjective, not objective in the way that science can be objective. And I think one of the things that surprised me through my philosophical education is actually how objective philosophy can be. But that is something I didn't know through my undergraduate and graduate studies, precisely because I didn't have a liberal arts education. I was an engineer as an undergrad, and I was a molecular biologist as a doctoral student, and within that, I had maybe two classes in anything other than STEM, mm-hmm. Right? And so the notion that one would read widely, think about big questions simply was not an option in the education that I had. And it was the Dominican Order having to start from another bachelor's degree to start all over, and then the formation of trying to think widely. So now let's just go back to the scientific enterprise today. If we look at the scientific enterprise today, the scientific enterprise is the search for knowledge. But we have to ask this question, why are we searching for this knowledge? Is the knowledge a good in itself? Now, the Christian tradition will propose that everything the human being will do, or has done, because we are human beings, is always in service of the human person. So whatever you do, because you are a human person, everything you do, the standard ethical moral guide should be to do what you do for the sake of another person. It's an articulation of the golden rule, put in another way. Now, if that is the case, then you can see how, even though science, properly speaking, is the search for knowledge. It is search of knowledge ordered towards a further good. The good either of simply wisdom, understanding within the human community. And this is something that's important to talk about, because a lot of people will argue that science is purely utilitarian. It's purely for the sake of coming up with cures. It cannot be that. There has to be an inherent good, that knowing something, even if you cannot apply it in some way to help someone else, is an inherent good. Knowing something and sharing that truth with another person, that itself is a good. That's the speculative part of science. And then there's the practical part of science. You're in a medical facility. Hopefully the things that are done in this medical facility are ordered in some way towards the bedside, the patient, the clinic. But I want to stress that both are good, and both are equally good, because both of them are ordered towards the human person. This actually gives an orientation to science, because now if the scientist attempts to do an experiment, and I'm thinking here, for example, of the Nazi scientists who are willing to do experiments that undermined the dignity of the human person for many, many reasons. What this account of science will say is that that person is actually not doing science properly, so-called. Because science has to be ordered towards the human person, the good of the human person, and if you're in any way undermining or destroying that, you are not doing science. You are not achieving the end for which science is supposed to be there. So now what I'm going to do in the third part and final part is to reflect specifically as a Catholic scientist in a post-Christian society. And I'm going to rely on a letter, so I put it up here. There is a letter that now St. John Paul II wrote to the director of the Vatican Observatory on the 300th anniversary of the publication of Newton's Principia, which is the foundation for Newtonian physics. And in my science and religion class, my students read this letter alongside Dawkins, and we compare and contrast the account of science here. And in this letter, which is addressed to scientists, not necessarily Catholic scientists, not even Christian scientists, what the Pope does is he articulates, especially for the believing scientists, what he imagines the role of the scientist should be in a post-Christian society, a pluralistic society. And he articulates several things. So the first thing he points out is that we live in an age of fragmentation. The idea that there is an overarching story in which we all find ourselves is inherently taboo, because the individual is primary, not the group. And what he points out is that science is one way, it's the primary secular way to try to come up with a story that can encompass everybody. And that science in itself is attempting to do that. Theology is doing the same thing. So he says that scientists, especially scientists who are believing scientists, have a responsibility to bring these two, let's just call search for grand unified theories, but not in the physics sense, but in the wisdom sense, in conversation with each other. Now, what is really interesting is if you look at evolutionary psychology, and if you look at people who talk about religion, who talk about stories of a nation, they will point out that it's very hard to keep human beings in a cohesive unit. And that part of what human beings have done over the course of our evolution is we have stories that we shared with each other to tell each other why we are part of the group. And there are people who have speculated that part of the reason why we struggle with so much social strife today is that there is no story that places the individual citizen in a common narrative for what it means to be an American. There used to be that narrative, but that narrative now has been undermined and challenged as being a product of the powerful attempting to impose a narrative on the not-so-powerful. And so that whole story is being undermined. The revolutionary psychologists have proposed that this will cause difficulties, because in order for us to live as a coherent social unit, we need to have these meta-narratives. Now, what the Pope is suggesting, that these meta-narratives, yes, scientific, but of course, he will say, more properly theological, are absolutely necessary for the flourishing of the human person. And that we have to talk with each other in order to come up with one narrative that helps us see our place in the world. This is why I spend an enormous amount of time looking about Adam and Eve. For a Catholic theologian, the account of original sin, the account of historical fall, the account of the Garden of Eden, and I don't mean here like a geographical place somewhere in the Middle East. I'm talking about a state of perfection has to be reconciled with the very best science that we have today, which talks about primarily out of Africa, with origins in Eastern and Southern Africa over the course of the last 100,000 years. Can you actually come up with an account that is coherent with that biology, that explains a historical fall, that explains an original ancestor, that explains... Now, one of the things I'm proposing is you can, and this is incredibly controversial, but one of the things that I'm doing, and especially looking at linguistics and looking at the bilinguistic program that is championed primarily by Noam Chomsky at MIT, where he talks about how a single mutation gave rise for the linguistic capacity in our species, which is really striking. Because if he says it, that you require a single mutation that allows you to do what he calls merge, which is the foundation of a hierarchical language, then he will say this appeared in one human being, one hominin in that population, about 10,000, which is the smallest number of hominins you can probably get to account for the genetic diversity in the 21st century, one of those became a speaking primate. But if that's the case, then you can develop a theological account of Adam and Eve based on that, you see? And the fact that all of us have this mutation because all of us are able to speak tells you that we must be descended from this individual person. So this kind of synthetic conversation is the kind of conversation the Pope says scientists, especially Catholic scientists, have a very important role in. Now, as I point out to my peers, being a Catholic historian is very different from being a Catholic scientist. Because whenever I go to meetings, the assumption, because I'm a priest, is I'm dumb. If you are a historian going to a meeting of the American History Association, and if you are a priest, that is not the assumption. But the assumption when I go to meetings, and my students accompany me to meetings, is that I'm just either foolish, deluded, or stupid. And I have one student here from my former research student who's now a postdoc here at Hopkins, and he can tell you whenever we go to meetings, and people will say, your PI is a priest? What's up with that? You know, and I will go to poster sessions, and people will say, Father, I work with Drosophila. That's the little fly. If you put the banana out, you know, the little fly shows up. And I go, where's the loading control for that? You know, we get the shocked look. We have the conversation. And then it's really interesting. We spend 25 minutes having a wonderful conversation over the poster. They get on the poster. At the very end, they go, but... And the assumption is, why? How? See? And what the Pope in his letter is suggesting is that the assumption in a post-Christian society is that science and religion are necessarily rivals, are necessarily opposed to each other, and that Catholic scientists, Christian scientists, in their very person, in their very life, witness to the possibility that a coherent narrative can be given for how belief in God and belief in science are not opposed. Now, you know, of course, that when Francis Collins was nominated to be director of the NIH, a letter was circulated in the United States among some of the most foremost scientists, biologists in our country, opposed to his nomination because many of our peers, were convinced that a Christian could not be a legitimate scientist. Even after he had spearheaded the sequencing of the human genome, you would think that the data would be enough, but the kind of bias that a Catholic scientist will face in the scientific academy is very different from the kind of bias that a Catholic historian will face. Because when I speak to my colleagues who are historians, and it doesn't even come up. It just doesn't come up. And so the vocation of the Catholic scientist, the Christian scientist, the scientist who is able to walk two worlds, the world of science and the world of faith, is to witness to the coherence of the two. Now, this requires education, you see? Because what actually has to happen, and this is the thing that all the time, is my colleagues at meetings will ask me, we'll start talking about yeast ER microenvironment and how this is altered by calcium dynamics, but very quickly, we will talk about the philosophical and metaphysical foundations for why I find it is reasonable for me to be a believer. And so there's an added challenge for Catholic scientists, for Christian scientists, for believing scientists, and it is that you have to develop the sophistication so that you can give an account for the hope that you have in the gospel in a way that our colleagues in the academy who are not scientists don't necessarily face on a day-to-day basis in terms of the existential pressure. Now, when I go to the AAAS meeting or if I go to the AACR meeting, it's really interesting. I go as a priest. I have people who walk up to me and they go, "I believe in God too." And they just walk away. You see? It's a very interesting scenario.
You ever had someone come up and ask you to hear the confession?
Yes, that too. Not in the middle of the convention hall. But it is really interesting. It's like I'm just walking through. It's like, "I'm a Christian." And I, shh. Well, I'm going to keep it on the secret side. I'm in the middle of the convention. If you know it, you know, if you are a Christian who is a scientist, you know what I mean. There is a perception, again, that the scientist cannot be a believer, or if he is or she is, that negatively impacts his or her ability to do real science. Now, I sit, by the grace of God, on the board of the Society of Catholic Scientists, which was founded a year and a half ago. And one of the things that we are trying to do is we're establishing a fellowship of scientists. We have graduate student members now. We have PIs, full professors, tenured professors. It's really interesting because we have a public membership list that we had to give an option to opt out because there were many PIs who were not willing to be on that member list until they got tenure. And they were like, "2 years from now, when I get tenure, you can put me on there. But right now, I have to be on the DL because people in the department are not aware that I am actually a believer, and that may negatively impact my ability to get tenure." And you see, I bring this up not only in the context of the Pope's letter, but to see that it requires enormous amount of virtue in order to be the Catholic scientist that who are called to be, for individuals who are called to be Catholic scientists today, it's not just about a matter of being a good scientist. It is also about a person who is called to be a witness to the coherence of faith and science, a witness to the personal and transforming power with an encounter with a living God, and with a certain humility, because science is so often arrogant. And the Pope is, at the end of the day, he says, the Catholic scientist, the Christian scientist, is first a witness to how science is done for the glory of God. Which is why the title of my talk, you know, goes wonder to wisdom with a small blip with knowledge. But as a Catholic priest, as a scientist, I have to move it one step further. I'm going to say it's worship. Because John Paul, in one of the talks, not this particular letter, but one of his talks to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, is that doing an experiment is an act of worship. They drive me crazy, some experiments, and yet to think that in running a gel, that act of running a gel, because I was acknowledging that I am looking at the Creator, the work of the Creator, was an act of saying, wow, you're really a cool Creator. And doing that is an act of worship. It's like going into the Louvre and looking at a painting and just speaking to the artist and saying, that is an amazing painting. You're really talented. And the Pope suggests that whenever a scientist does this, whether he knows it or not, whether he's a believer or not, he's acknowledging the incredibly beautiful creative power of the first cause. Which is why when you do experiments, if you are a Catholic, if you are a believer, remember that despite the ninth failure, that act, in spite of the failure, is in many ways a humbling of yourself in front of the Creator God. It reveals his power. And, you know, in so many ways, that 18 months of hell during my PhD program, the slump, you know, the parts where it just did not work, and I got dumped too, that was bad. So, like, all of that together, I can see now was Providence working in my life to prepare me to encounter the living God, because I was going to be called to the order of preachers. And when you have that wisdom, now here the wisdom is a theological transcendent wisdom, where you can see even in the bad things you have received, not just the gifts, but some of the bad things, that God is even working there to provide concrete guidance to one's life. It allows you in a way that Aristotle couldn't have imagined to see a big picture that goes beyond the cosmos. It's a grand unifying theory that exceeds the expectations of Stephen Hawking. It's the ability to see it all the way. And so the witness value is precisely a person who is able to live a life with that horizon in mind. What are you like in love if you are a Christian? You know, are you the type of person where someone says there's something different about this person? You know, the swearing is minimal, even if the experiments fail. What is it? And so in closing, I would like to just say, you know, when I went to MIT for my PhD, the last thing on my mind is that I would become a Catholic priest. I wanted to cure cancer and win the Nobel Prize. And I wanted to do that by uncovering the genetic basis for aging. But it was through that struggle, which is science, right? That struggle to find truth. I'll never forget the night I realized I had cloned my gene. Of course, it happens at 2:00 in the morning, and after 18 months, it finally happened, you know, and I had basically had to pull out this incredibly ancient or dated library from the fridge that was that involved a low copy plasmid, so that my gene was actually represented in a way that I could complement my mutation. And I was so excited, I went out and grabbed Mario Rocuzzo, who was the custodian on my floor, there was no one else. And I grabbed him into the lab and I showed him my tetrads, and I said, look, it's 2-2. He had no idea what the heck I was describing. But in that moment, I knew something that no one else had ever known before. And it is that wonder. You see, it's that wonder. It's interesting because philosophers have pointed out that knowledge can satiate curiosity, but it can never completely address wonder. Wonder is such that solving one question leads to 10 others. And I think that what I discovered at MIT was that what was most wonderful about the world that I was studying was behind it, there was a triune God. Thank you very much.